Good afternoon, America. Good morning, Australia, and everyone listening live on social media today. You're listening to Radio Tony, and today we have a wonderful guest. And today's show is called Up in the Air with Robert Fulton. Now, just a quick reminder, if you want to find out any more about Radio Tony or appearing on this show, please jump onto the website radiotony.com. You will also find links to all of our guests and all of their information if you miss anything from the show today. For all of you listening live on Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Twitch, we have Paleo in the background listening, ready to answer your questions and send you links if you miss anything from the live interview. Paleo is my wonderful assistant from the Philippines, and I'm very appreciative to have his help on the show today. A warm welcome to TJ, who is our technician in the background. And before I introduce you to our amazing guest for today on the show, I just want to tell you a little bit about Robert Fulton. We're going to have two shows together, and our guest today is an inspirational reinvention specialist. He's an author and a pilot. Robert Fulton was 3 months shy of retirement, having fully vested in his employer's retirement plan when they pulled his program and laid everyone off. Robert was forced to reinvent himself, and for the first time in his life, in his 50-year career, he was grounded. Robert had to figure out how to overcome PTSD, deep depression, and work out what on earth he was going to do in his late 60s without a retirement plan. Out of that time was born a book, Up in the Air, A Pilot's Journey, his aviation memoir spanning 50 years. Robert is also an award-winning speaker with Toastmasters, and he now speaks on overcoming obstacles, reinvention, retirement, and leadership. Good afternoon, Robert. Welcome to Radio Tony. We're delighted to have you here today.
Thank you, Tony. It's great to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Now, I want to start at the very beginning of you. You discovered a love of flying or an interest in being above the earth quite early in life, and it's a special story. And I'd like to start telling that story to the listeners about that early love of flying and where it came from.
I'd be happy to. I was in the garden with my little sister. I guess I was 4 or 5 years old. My mother had just made breakfast. She was watering her plants. The dust we were kicking up made it feel like fresh rain. My father was working at the sawmill. Mm-hmm. A blimp. My mother said, "Look up in the sky, kids." And there was a blimp. Now, a blimp is like the Hindenburg, but much smaller. And the U.S. Navy used to use them for coastal patrol still right after World War II. So a blimp is a lighter-than-air type airship with a kind of a little house underneath it where they have the controls and so on.
It's kind of like an elongated hot air balloon, really, isn't it?
Right. It's almost like a cigar with propellers underneath it. Yeah. No smoke, hopefully. Yeah. So I can still, in my mind's eye, see that that picture in the back garden and my looking up and seeing the blimp. And my mom said, "Look, Rob, your dad is waving down at you." And I stared at the blimp, and I never, I guess, considered the sky. I knew what a cloud was, and I would imagine different cloud shapes, but it never occurred to me that you could cross the sky in some kind of a machine. And we watched until it disappeared behind the trees. But of course, my mother knew my dad was not up there, but it was a fantasy. Yeah. It was fun. And it was a nice way to introduce me to aviation. And somehow a switch turned on in my head. And there was always a certain magic in thinking of flying in the, you know, being up in the sky, up in the air.
Yeah. And that's where it started for you. That first sight of a blimp was the thing that tipped your imagination as a young boy. You grew up in Canada, Robert, and obviously you're very much in the US now and have been for a long time. What was it like, and when did you move from Canada to the US?
Well, my parents were in the Royal Canadian Air Force during World War II. And I was born in Regina, Saskatchewan, but I was only a year or so old when they came to the States. And I grew up in Olympia, which is south of Seattle. So I grew up in the Pacific Northwest there. I had relatives in Calgary, Alberta. So we made a trip every summer and spent it in Canada. So my A stayed with me, the Canadian. Yeah, exactly. I don't know if that's the case in Australia or not. So I grew up in Olympia. When I was in high school, I worked on a ranch west of Calgary, close to the Rocky Mountains. Mm-hmm. So I knew there were helicopters up there in Calgary. And that was kind of the story of how Canada figured into my future there.
Your flight story. Before we get on to that, though, there's an interesting story from your childhood. You were surrounded by women in your life, and there was something you learned to do about the age of 8. What was that?
Well, my grandmother and my grandfather lived with us. My mother was a single mom, and my sister, myself. I would go shopping with her. My sister wanted a pleated skirt. And it was going to the store, it was too much money to buy one. And my mother was convinced she could make one. I wasn't the hands-on, but I stood there and can remember standing there in the shop having someone explain carefully how to pleat a skirt. Now, my mother introduced bagpipes early on in our life, and I get tears in my eyes now when I hear the bagpipes. But the tartan, the idea of a kilt, may have been stirring my interest there. So I watched her lay out the pattern. I couldn't do it today, but I did. That's the kind of a young life I had, very influenced by those kinds of things.
Yeah. Very interesting. For those listeners that would like to know, pleating a skirt or any sort of pleating is quite a lot more difficult than you think. You have to be quite precise with the measurements and the folding and the pinning and then the sewing. And it really is not something that you can do. It takes quite a lot of practice to learn how to pleat and sew a skirt. And that's what Robert learnt all those years back then. Now, Robert, as you grew older, and here's where the story gets interesting, when you spoke before about going back to Calgary and working on a ranch, there's a story about how you got started in flight school and what you did to try and get your pilot's license. So from that first sighting of a blimp when you were really little at 4, you still had that interest and love of wanting to learn to fly carried through into teenage years. And this is where the story gets interesting. So you were in Calgary. What were you doing besides working on the ranch?
Well, I worked on the ranch when I was in high school. And so when I was married young, I was just 21, and I went up to Calgary to see if I could sink some roots down there and see what the flying opportunities were. Of course, the Great White North and the Arctic, there's lots of territory up there, and so helicopters were very important. Now, I didn't really think about helicopters, and that wasn't where I was headed. I found an initial job there in the city, but then hanging around the airport, I was thinking, gosh, maybe I could get a job here and maybe I could start learning to fly. So I went to the ranch that I had worked on. They had kind of an old bunkhouse that they'd lived in previously. It was 4 rooms, I believe, a living room, 2 bedrooms, and a bath. No hot water, no plumbing, but they would let us stay there for free.
In Calgary, there was no hot water.
No, this was on a ranch west of town. They had it in their house, but this is when we first on the farm, they lived in this little old bunkhouse. So I got a job at the airport pumping gas 6 days a week, and I was able to afford the low wages because we lived out on this ranch with no plumbing. Mm-hmm. And one bath a week and up in that tin tub that you'd probably today wash your dog in. heating the water. So there's a lot more to that story, but that was the extent that I was willing to sacrifice. Whether my wife was that motivated, I couldn't say, but she didn't protest at the time.
Yeah, yeah. So you went on to get your or start on your private pilot's license training, yeah?
That's correct. I made a deal with the people at the airport, and by part of my wages, they would give me a discount so I could, I was working towards my private license.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And in those days, it was really quite expensive, wasn't it, Robert, to get that license?
Yes. When you think of today's dollars, it was, you know, it was in the thousands.
Yeah.
And very expensive. Yes. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I got my private eventually and got very good training, by the way. And
yes.
But I saw that going on with my commercial license so I could earn a living was going to be very expensive. And then at the end of it, I'd have no real experience. I'd have to go find some kind of a job to build the experience, which is very difficult when you, no one wants to give you an airplane when you only have 150 hours in the air.
So we
went back.
They're big and expensive.
Yes. So we went back to the States, and I was thinking of going to school so that I could get in the Air Force program and be a fighter pilot. And, but I kept running out of money, and I didn't know about student loans, if they even had them.
Yes.
And then I would get back in. And so it got to be kind of a vicious circle. So one day I was walking down through the main town, and there on the in the barbershop was posted a mimeograph sheet talking about the U.S. Army. And they didn't expect a college degree. They were happy with a high school degree and an interview. And if you pass these hurdles, then you could join the Army and go to flight school, which I did. I showed up at flight school and said, I'm here to fly a real nice airplane. Have you got any? They said, you're going to fly a helicopter. Get in the line over there by the door. So I had a small. Go ahead.
What was your first thought when they said helicopters versus airplanes? Were you like, oh, my God?
Well, kind of. It wasn't that I was afraid of helicopters. I'd been around them a little.
No.
But it didn't occur to me that you could make a living in a helicopter. It's a very specialized type piece of equipment, not a big industry. And I didn't even know how they stayed up in the air. But I had a small airplane before I got in the Army. And I thought, oh, this flight school, I already know how to fly. This is going to be no problem. But the only thing I knew how to do when I got in the helicopter was read a map. Other than that, it was a brand new thing.
Oh, my goodness. And so you weren't scared of the actual flying, but you were a bit trepidatious about the actual helicopters? Because I imagine that they've advanced a lot to modern time, haven't they? They were not well used, not as much used as they are now. Like there's helicopters everywhere now, but they weren't prolific back then when you started, were they, Robert?
No, at that time, they were piston engine powered, which are very heavy engines. So they had to make the helicopter bigger and the engines bigger, and the maintenance was horrific. But because of the war in Vietnam, they started putting turbine engines in the helicopter, which lightened them a great deal. But you're correct, there was a very small industry. It only had helicopters in it that were, well, kind of like MASH, if anyone knows what MASH with the big bubble helicopter. Yes. That's kind of what was around there working at the time. Yes.
Robert, were they predominantly in the armed forces helicopters? Like they weren't using them in like civilian life that much way back
not
then,
that much. Geological type exploration in these bubble helicopters. Yeah. A lot of that. And early on in Canada, there was a company out of Vancouver and a couple of companies in Calgary that started because of the exploration and the vastness of Canada. It was kind of a good place to start with the helicopter. There wasn't much in the States. Later, going offshore to oil rigs was kind of the main use for helicopters.
Yeah. So, when you learnt how to fly a helicopter, they sent you off to Vietnam then, didn't they?
Right. They graduated 600 pilots a month after 9 months of training. You had about 150 hours. And you were motivated because if you flunked out of flight school, they gave you a rifle and sent you straight to Vietnam as a buck private in the jungle. So you studied, stayed late, and tried to do well on all your tests. And learning to fly a helicopter is very challenging. The way they didn't really have it down pat like they do today. They made you get in the helicopter with an instructor. They wouldn't let you do anything else until you learned to hover. So you had to learn to hover, which means you had to stay over one place on the ground.
And that's quite difficult.
It would be like riding a bucking bronco 3 or 4 hours a day. Yeah. So it took me about 4 hours to learn to hover. And then they flew with you a little longer. And then they put you in the helicopter with somebody else that had 10 hours. And you had 10 hours and off you went to practice.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So in those early training days, were there any mishaps?
Yes. We had two or three midairs a month at least. I was looking right at this point in space when there was a midair. There were a fair number of accidents, but you were in kind of a big machine and you just kept moving. No one stopped. They had to produce the numbers. So someone else came and took care of the wrecks and the different things that happened. A lot of guys ran out of gas in stiff winds. The helicopter only went 60. And sometimes we'd be up in winds that were 30 or 40 miles an hour. So pretty hard to plan your fuel. So.
Wow. So it really was quite a different time in aviation at that time when you first learnt to fly the helicopters then, wasn't it?
Yes, it was far from traditional. And I think a lot of people, it was almost the eighth wonder of the world. And a lot of people just didn't realize what was going on down there in Texas.
Now, listen, next week, we're going to dive into a few of your stories from Vietnam and tell the listeners next week about some of those stories from war and combat, because you then went to Vietnam as a combat helicopter pilot, and lots of adventures, and gratefully we still have you here to tell us about that. But I want to quickly get on to something that's happened more recently. And you've had this beautiful, long, wonderful career in and around flight. And as you were preparing for your retirement, you'd planned and had it all organized, but something happened that changed everything. What was that, Robert?
Well, I had been in the midst of building the program up. I just spent $4 million. We refurbished the helicopters and so on. And one afternoon, about 4 PM, I got a call from HR. Is that a familiar term with you? Human resources, personnel.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're nice people. You don't want to get a call from them. But anyway, I was asked to show up at 8 o'clock the next morning, and they announced that they were closing the program, laying off all the pilots and myself, and that was the end. They gave us a small package, a 1 month type of thing. I only had 3 months to go to be vested in my retirement, so I fell short on that.
What a horrible situation. So this was quite a big flight school that you worked for, and they'd been operational for quite a while, hadn't they, Robert?
Yes, this was, I was managing the hospital helicopter program, and the county owned it and ran it, and it had been 30 years. And, of course, I was only there 6 or 7 years, but they closed all that down. And there was, as it turned out, there was some corruption of overcharging by the county. I don't know all the details. They were never really able to explain it to the taxpayers, but it disappeared. And I went home, and that was the end of my flying career.
Oh, Robert.
It was kind of, I call it crash retirement.
Absolutely, crash. So that company, did they
Excuse me, go ahead.
Did they provide helicopter services to hospitals and health, or did they train the pilots in hospital and healthcare retrievals?
No, we had two helicopters and we operated in the county there. We would fly trauma cases to the hospital, and then we would take burn victims up to Tampa, which is about 100 miles north, and then Miami is 100 and some miles west, southeast of us. We would fly special needs people there. So it was about keeping the helicopters up, the pilots trained, and meeting all the requirements. And that, in that kind of flying, you're, you know, the bell can go off at 2 a.m. and it can be foggy and dark. And there's all kinds of things that you have to face suddenly. And that's the kind of program we had.
Yeah. Because people, they don't damage themselves in daylight hours between business hours. They might be hiking up a mountain somewhere and have a fall, or be at sea and boat collapse. Like, for helicopter pilots in that environment, the diversity of what you might encounter over a normal day is quite massive, isn't it? And you've got critically, or may have critically injured people on that helicopter as well.
Yes. And my book, you know, I have a chapter on Vietnam, but it's not a Vietnam book. And there is a chapter in there on this part of my stories. I think the people that have read my book, that have been drawn to it, not for the aviation aspect, for the storytelling, they've been very moved by some of the stories about the what we call EMS, life flight missions.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 My nursing background, before I had my first baby, I worked in a remote community in like the middle of Australia, and lots of their critical patients were moved by helicopter or small plane. And I was next on the list to be a flight nurse at that stage. And unfortunately, I fell pregnant, and they said, well, no, you can't go because you're pregnant. One of the itsy bitsy regrets, not the baby, but the being involved in flight nursing, because that element of you not quite sure what you're going to get or what you're going to encounter, and you have to be very prepared for whatever. You would know too, Robert, that Australia is a big country and with lots of remote areas, and they are reliant on helicopters and planes to retrieve people and take them to the centres, much like the work that you were involved in. So, Robert, you get this horrible information on an afternoon. How do you go home and tell your family, and what was the impact on you?
Well, I didn't see it coming at all. I was, like I said, I was in the middle of building up some pretty sophisticated weather type approaches and benefits for the helicopter. And I had been writing all new regulations and so on. So when I went home, I told my wife, I was kind of flabbergasted. I sat in my chair and pretty much stared at the wall for about 4 months, I would say, at least.
Yeah.
I had no idea. For almost 50 years of my life, I'd had an airplane or a helicopter to climb into, or to touch, or to get into, or to train somebody in. And now they were as far gone as they might as well have been on Mars. I had no access to any aircraft.
Yeah.
And, I had no idea what to do. And of course, my salary was suddenly cut significantly.
Yes.
And my wife did work. She works with Alzheimer's patients, but my salary was cut by more than half. So we had to make that adjustment. I have a lot of interest and there's a lot of things I like to do, but at that particular time I was zeroed out. I had no idea what to do or where to turn.
It really took the wind out of your sails and completely disrupted all of your plans. And you were ready for retirement. So I can't begin to imagine the trauma that put you into. And I guess that leads us to a discussion about the deep depression that overcome you after that time, Robert.
Well, you know, the depression was, it was hard-edged because I thought I had been doing a great job and I had a vision of where we were headed, and we had built up a very sophisticated program. I'd have to say, not putting myself on the back, but the fact that the county was willing at that time to make the commitments, we were probably in the top 10 or 15% in terms of equipment and capability in the whole country. And having been involved in that every day, having been had contacts, and some of it was just coming to fruition. That was one of the hard parts, letting go of that and untangling myself from those expectations. And then I had never really thought of retirement per se. I knew I was up there in the age, but I honestly, this isn't realistic, but I thought I'd still be flying today kind of thing. And so that, trying to get my head around the fact that I was at the end of the road, that was not easy. I had no idea where to go next, because I don't know if a lot of, I think a lot of men are identify with what they do. And when that's gone, your identity's gone. And I wasn't one to go around saying, oh, I'm a pilot or anything like that. But in your own head, you're proud of what you've done. You know you've come a long ways.
Yes.
And you want to build on it. And now it's gone. You're never going to build on it, you know. So
So it really just destroyed lots of parts of you that I guess you probably felt like you weren't going to ever put back together again. So what was the thing that started you back on a path towards living a better life and not just focused on that terrible situation where everything you'd worked towards has been ripped out from you? How did you start to put yourself back together, Robert?
Well, we went to a dinner party. It wasn't a holiday dinner party, but it was a small dinner party that my wife's, the people she worked with were having. And we met a couple there, and Bill and Marianne Osher. And Marianne had been a relationship counselor and was trying to get her license to be a retirement advisor or counselor. We got talking, we were introduced. I don't want to confuse anybody, but the Atlantic Monthly, which is a major newspaper, or a major magazine, if you know that magazine, they did an article on this story I'm telling you with original illustrations and everything. I can give you the link later. But Marianne said she needed a bunch of time with the patient in order to apply for the license. So without cost, she took me on and, it was like, if I wouldn't have had
a glimmer of hope
moment just where that crossing was, I'm not sure. So she got me thinking about what I wanted to do, had me write exercises like, what's a perfect day for you? I'd always wanted to write, but I was pretty frantically involved in raising a family and flying and traveling and being at all the ends of the earth. So I never really wrote much. My wife had suggested I take a child's literature class several years before, and I'd poked away at it, but nothing consistent. So I kind of boiled it down to maybe I could write. And I didn't think, oh, I could be a writer, but I thought maybe I could write something. And I had a pretty pulverizing experience in Vietnam.
And this was
I had tried to put it on paper for 30 years and I hadn't succeeded. And sometime in the year before the retirement thing, I got 11 pages of computer text down about that event. And then I just left it alone. But Marianne got me thinking about writing, and my wife encouraged me. I took a writing class, and I've always been a little resistant to writing classes because I don't want to, I want to have the freedom to have my own style. And that may have been arrogant. I don't know, but it worked out okay for me. But I went to the local college and took some of the things I'd written down, and they were accepted. They thought, well, that was pretty good. So I went, so from that moment of those 4 months, meeting Marianne, having her give me challenging exercises, having me get to think, no, I wasn't where I could just sit on the couch and wait to die. Now I had control of my own time. I could make my own decisions. Yeah. I could do all kinds of wonderful things. And turning that page over between working and retirement is a heavy turn for a lot of people.
Yes.
Some get crushed by the page weight. Others go on, and I feel like I've never had been in a better spot in my whole life than I have these last few years. So I took the 11 pages and I wrote some more about Vietnam, and then I had a chapter, and then I thought, well, maybe I could write another chapter, and I wrote another chapter, and this happened over, I'll say, a year. I got kind of five chapters together, and they're all different. I was in the Arctic at 60 below zero. And I was a logging pilot. I was a crop dusting pilot. I was an airline pilot flying DC-9s. I was a hospital pilot. I sprayed a lot of potatoes so you could all have French fries. But anyway, so it's fairly long list, and I never realized, because all I was trying to do was not to be Joe Superpilot. I was trying to just make a living, keep shoes on the kids' feet, and keep going.
Yeah.
And, the kids, we had moved all over the country, zigzagging everywhere to find the next best flying job. And anyways, so in the end, that came out to be quite a list. And, I met a publisher, and he was a self-publisher at a speaking seminar.
Yes.
And he encouraged me that, he said, well, we can help you here. And I said, okay, I'll have this book done by April. It's 4 months. So I wrote the next five chapters in 4 months. I didn't go with him, but I was glad that I did it. And then I went to work trying to put together a cover. And that was very interesting. And how that all works. I went through three artists.
Yes.
I couldn't get anybody to kind of get onto what I had in mind. And the last person said she couldn't do it at all. But then she, 24 hours later, there it was. So I had all kinds of interesting experiences and met a lot of wonderful people. And did some speaking and got to be well known a bit on the about the retirement challenges and some of those things.
Yes.
So I don't know if I've been long winded on that, but so, it was a pivotal point.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. The whole retirement debacle and the depression that it tipped you into, it also triggered some of that post Vietnam trauma as well. And that was the first time you started to deal with some of that trauma from your time in Vietnam, wasn't it? When you started to write down notes, that was the first time that you'd allowed yourself to revisit some of the trauma from Vietnam, Robert?
Yes, absolutely. I tried, I thought about it. I'd get a sentence or two down, you know, but
and then it was just too tough.
Yeah, it was too tough. This is my book, and just to show you that there was a book in the cover.
There is. Yep.
It is real.
Listeners, we're going to get to the book. We promise we're going to get to the book.
I know. I just wanted to show people that the book was actually completed. But yes, the Vietnam, I hate to say PTSD, but that's what it was. I know there are people that suffer tremendously from it.
Yeah.
It's even now.
It's difficult.
It's over almost 40 years later.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's not that you forget it. It's that you put it in a place where you can deal with it better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess being in that situation where you've no longer got the job that you love and were so invested in, it's a prime time for things that you haven't thought about or hadn't wanted to think about to come up. And so for you, that's been very helpful. and the healing, or the starting to heal and talk about that trauma, has gone into the pages of Up in the Air. And it's a very, I'm really grateful that you have come on the show, Robert, and been so vulnerable with our listeners and watchers, because there are many, 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 many people out there that suffer from PTSD. And the Vietnam War in particular seems to have a huge cohort of returned veterans that have never spoken about what they were subjected to, what they went through, and their own individual traumas. And no one's trauma suffered during the Vietnam War was more or less than anyone else's. It's just that there wasn't support for you guys when you returned home, was there?
No, we were young, and nobody put their arms around you when you came home. The cousins I grew up with and my favorite aunt and uncle haven't spoken to me since the day I came home.
Still to this day, Robert.
Yeah, so we all had to work through that. And the VA wasn't organized. People weren't really trying to help you with it. It came out more during Afghanistan and so on. But
I was going to say, for people my age, who I was kind of born just before the Vietnam War, I didn't have family that were involved, but I know from my numerous discussions with many people who have returned from the Vietnam War that there was trauma not just in the war, but there was trauma when you came home, because people were so horrible and unaccepting based on the fact of whether they disagreed or agreed with the war. And the fundamental issue was that you guys had no choice. You were told to go, and you were told to do what you were told to do, and there was no correspondence. So you came home traumatized, and then you were re-traumatized by what happened and the lack of support when you got home. So for many of you, and this is Robert's story as well, the processing or the need to process those traumas of war, and we have to accept that war is traumatic for everyone involved, isn't it, Robert?
Yes. Yeah, it was, you know, I flew 300 combat missions, but there were guys on the ground that were cooks or fixed the trucks or whatever, and they had their issues too. And it wasn't like there was a front line. We were surrounded all the time with rocket attacks. And, you know, you were in the middle of a war. You weren't waiting to push the enemy back along a certain line. They were all around you. They were everywhere. It was hard to sort it out. I didn't have any tools to go from basically a teenage kid.
I was going to say, you were a young man. You know, we have to put this into context, that these young, predominantly young men, and remembering that young men's brains do not develop until they're 25, these kids from as young as, you know, 17, 18, were sent to a war zone ill-equipped to cope with the types of trauma that they would see, hear, and have to deal with. And so that's why I think it's really important when we're talking to these amazing veterans who are being vulnerable enough to talk about their experiences, and for Robert to actually put that down in paper, so that other people can read about and understand just what they went through. And the horrible retirement situation just, I guess, forced you to start to deal with some of that trauma. And that trauma you've written into this amazing book called Up in the Air by Robert Fulton. And for those of you listening live, we've got links to where you can buy Robert's book right now. I know from talking to Robert and others and reading the reviews, many, many women who have husbands or partners in aviation of any description are buying this book in droves and giving it to their partners as a read. And I would suggest too that for any of your relatives that are perhaps still suffering from the effects of the Vietnam War, this would also be a helpful read for them as well. where Robert openly talks about some of those situations. So we have you at retirement, unceremoniously dumped from a job you love in a role that you've done all of your life, set by yourself at home in the deep, dark depression and starting to think about the Vietnam War and what it did. And writing became a release for you, didn't it, Robert?
It was one. I had a great editor, which I was very fortunate, just like hooking up with Marianne, that helped me. But I immersed myself in it. I went back, examined emotions, and pulled things up. I had great recall, not patting myself on the back, but I had notes.
No, that's good.
Yeah. So some of these things, I can paint a picture for you because they're in my mind very, very vividly. A lot of the reviews are from women who bought them maybe for their husbands, but their husbands told them a few stories. So then they jumped in and read the book because if you love stories, even if you're not an aviator,
it's for everyone.
The one professional review I have was by an Indian young lady, and with blushing just a little, may I say, she called two of the chapters, and Vietnam was one of them, brilliant. And the book was well edited. So I'm glad I wanted to reach people that may, because there's an element of reinventing because of the variety I went to. I mean, flying a helicopter off of a 12-story hospital is not the same thing as driving a DC-9 down to 100 feet with 120 people sitting behind you at night in Richmond, Virginia. So just because you're a pilot, it does, just like I was telling you about the helicopter thing, there's all kinds of different elements. So I had to reinvent myself all the time. And people, often when you come to a new, like when I was logging, for example, the other pilots don't want to tell you the tricks because then you might learn more than they did or whatever. So you're pretty well on your own to learn these things. You know, I think that's a human nature thing, but anyway.
One of the things that helped, besides working with Marianne, who you attribute a lot of your assistance was from Marianne, but one of the other things besides writing that you started to do was to get involved with Toastmasters. And I just thought we'd get you to tell the audience about what Toastmasters is and how it helped with your recovery, Robert.
Yes, I'd like to address that. Thank you. Toastmasters is an international organization. It was started back in 2009, but somewhere close to that. It was exclusively male, unfortunately, until, if you can believe it, the early 70s.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the idea was of a Toastmaster was that you could give a speech. I guess it got its name from, making a toast. But it was about for businessmen to learn to speak, and eventually evolved into men and women who were young in business or old, it didn't matter, learning to speak, gaining, so you could gain confidence, but you could learn to speak. I went through my program, 50 some speeches, public speeches in 4 years, and got the distinguished Toastmaster Award. Marianne is the one at the end of the counseling that said, have you thought about Toastmasters? I'd heard of it from my mom, but I didn't know. And I'm like, okay, I'll do that. But I think I can speak pretty good. I just from like church or whatever. No, I was totally humbled. My knees shook for the first five speeches. My mouth got dry. It was a great experience. Yes. I had to come to grips with my limitations. Yes. And I love the creativity of having these different speeches. And one of the years I read, which I love to read books because I loved reading to my children. And I read to them always.
Yes.
And I've memorized in the last few years the Highwaymen by Alfred Noyes.
Yes.
That I used to read to my kids. I know all six pages by heart now. But I enjoy that kind of thing. So I met fabulous people. Marianne was involved there. And on the fourth month, I was like, you know what? I don't think I can do this, because people were super kind. Nobody was judgmental, but they were scoring you on every speech. So you were very, you know, sensitive. It wasn't that you were afraid of the criticism, because it was in a way that would help you grow. But I don't know what it was, but it took me at least a year and a half to get over my terror. And in the States, at least, I don't know if this is worldwide, 70% of the population fear public speaking than they do death.
Yes.
So it was another, filled another hole and took my mind off of things and made me feel more creative than I'd been before.
So do you think that because you'd had such this amazing career and you were focused on what we could describe as quite a technical career, do you think that your creativity was rejuvenated after this time, so that you discovered a creativity that you never thought that you had?
Yes, I would say. My mother wrote a book. She never got it published, and she read to us all the time. So I loved to read. And even though we were, what I would say, very poor, she would buy books from door-to-door salesmen and pay a dollar a month, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
And so I admired her for writing, but I never thought I could do it. And the thing about helicopters, and this is a little unusual, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but because it can be flown in every at every angle, at every direction, it's a very creative flying. You're not going 500 miles an hour, but believe me, when you have a hook below you 200 feet and you have to put it into somebody's hand, or you have to line up bolts for a ski lift or whatever you're doing, or fly off in the middle of the night and figure out a way to get down through the wires to land by the wrecked car, it's quite a creative process. I never really recognized that till later, but having unlocked this creativity where I could write a sentence that someone would actually said, that's a cool sentence, or that's a great story.
Yeah.
I loved that. I did love that. Yeah. And not in an ego building way, but just the satisfaction and the fact that I had it in me, if I would just work on it, to do it well.
Possibly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Robert, I'm really glad that you had someone to help you get through this. What would have been just a soul destroying experience for you, but I am very glad that part of that process was to write this wonderful book called Up in the Air. Now I want to read one of the reviews for our listeners today, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about the book. Of course, next week on our show with Robert, we're going to delve into those flight stories, which will be absolutely fun. But here's the review. So, an exciting flying memoir, a collection of autobiographical short stories from the author's experience as both a helicopter and fixed wing pilot. Robert Fulton's thrilling new memoir kept me turning the pages late into the night. Fulton writes gut-wrenching moments that brought me to tears and hair-raising experiences explained in detail. The author's wonderful storytelling puts the reader right in the pilot's seat through Vietnam, Arctic flying, perilous wire-filled cities, low visibility night flying. Up in the Air is an excellent read and will be enjoyed by pilots and passengers alike. Now, for those of you listening live online, Payo will put the links to get Robert's book in the chat. But for anyone else, you can find Up in the Air by Robert Fulton via his website, which is pilotsjourney.com, or on Amazon. Now, we spoke earlier in the interview about women buying the book for their husbands. However, everyone is enjoying the stories that you tell about your flight experiences, aren't they, Robert?
Yes. The review you just read was by a young mother. I think she's in her about 37 or something. And yes, it's been very satisfying. And I tried to not make it too technical. I've got a glossary in there, and it's about being a person meeting challenges as much as it is being a pilot trying to overcome the weather, so to speak. So,
and that's exactly what you've reinvented yourself in terms of, you know what it takes to be hit by life, so to speak, and to reinvent yourself in a way that is still authentically Robert Fulton. If someone had told you earlier in life that you would write an amazing book, what would you have thought?
I would have dismissed it fairly quickly. I did love to read, and I would have thought, well, that would be super, but I don't believe it's going to be by me. Yeah.
Are you glad that you sat with perseverance and wrote about some of the tough flight experiences you had, Robert?
Yes, it's probably some of the best time I've ever spent in my life.
Especially
those last five chapters, when I disciplined myself to write 3 hours a day, it didn't matter if I was hungry, the phone rang, I protected those 3 hours and wrote. And having a great editor to chew things around with was good. So
I was just going to say, professionally
edited, excuse me.
Editing is such an important component of writing a good book. And for anyone who's thinking about writing a book, make sure you have a budget set aside for a good editor, because they make the difference between a good book and a wonderful book, because they just encourage you in a way that you wouldn't normally encourage yourself. Is that how you describe it, Robert? They kind of tease things out a little bit more than what you would have, and they give you an encouragement or an insight that makes your book better.
Yes. Yes, it was great to work with her, see a different perspective, take suggestions. She was not an aviator. She was a literature professor at Arizona School that my wife had known earlier, and she agreed to take it on. And one of the treats was that she edited it, and I paid her the going rate. Yes. It was good.
Yes.
And then I thought, I'm done. And then she wrote me an email and said, Rob, I learned so much editing this book. I don't feel I gave you your money's worth. We're going to do it again.
Oh, no.
So not that the book was bad or anything, but she just felt like, no. And she actually put some of the stories back in the order I had them in, where she before had asked me to change everything around. So the book came back closer to where I had had it initially. But again, I got lots of great input. Yeah.
That's just fantastic. For listeners, we are going to chat again next week at the same time with Robert. But for those of you who are listening and want to grab this book and have a read before we talk to Robert, don't forget to jump on and find the book on Amazon or thepilotjourney.com is the website.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
A Pilot Journey.
A Pilot Journey.
There's no apostrophe. It's just A Pilot Journey.
No, that's okay. It's your book. For those of you listening live, Peo will put the links up into the chat box and the message place for you. For those of you who might be driving or listening and watching where you can't access a computer, if you jump onto RadioTony.com and look under my guest section, you will find all of Robert's information and link to his book as well. Now, Robert will be back next week, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Vietnam and some of the stories from the book without giving away too much of what's in the book. But they're wonderful stories for us to talk about. I do think it's incredibly important that we offer our Vietnam vets support, and therefore I'd really like to just touch on the PTSD with Robert again next week. Robert, thank you so much for coming on Radio Tony Up in the Air today so that we could talk about you, your journey, and your book. And we will be back next week with another episode of Robert's story, and in particular some flight stories that are interesting and fascinating Robert, thank you so much. I really appreciate you being vulnerable and open today to talk about depression and PTSD, which is really difficult for men in particular to appear live and have a vulnerable conversation. I'm sure that you will help many, many people just by being here today. Robert Fulton, thank you. I look forward to having you next week. We need to hand over to TJ now, and I'll see you all next week again. Bye for now.